A bevy of new research illustrates a greater need for bike infrastructure throughout downtown Cleveland. The Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency recently released a survey that shows Cleveland is lagging behind peer cities in terms of a network of protected bike lanes. And Bike Cleveland released their 2023 crash report, which documented 84 crashes in downtown, two of them being fatal. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Drew Mazias, in today for Jenny Hamill. To kick off the show today, we'll talk bike safety and how these reports can help bolster calls for more protected infrastructure. I'll be joined by representatives from NOAACA and Bike Cleveland. Later in the hour, my conversation with writer Erica Hauser. Her new book, The Age of Deer, Trouble in Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors, documents the long and complicated history that exists between humans and deer. That all heads your way right after the latest news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Drew Mazias in the host chair today while Jenny Hamill's on vacation. Thanks for joining us and happy Monday. Northeast Ohio boasts some great places to ride a bike. Summit County's Freedom Trail is a 7-mile jaunt that connects Akron and Kent. The Red Line Greenway and Lakefront Trails are some new assets on Cleveland's west side. And the lengthy Towpath Trail is truly a gem, attracting thousands of bikers, hikers, and walkers all year round. But notably absent from that list, downtown Cleveland. That's the big takeaway from a recent study by NOAACA, the Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency. The study not only highlights the lack of bike infrastructure in downtown, but also notes how many respondents to the survey don't feel safe riding in the city center. Those concerns over safety are also at the forefront of two releases from Bike Cleveland, their 2023 crash report, and another survey they undertook with the Baldwin-Wallace University Community Research Institute. To kick off the show today, we discuss bike infrastructure, safety, and what can be done to improve safety in the region. Stick around later in the show, my conversation with author Erica Hauser. She wrote The Age of Deer, and it examines the long and complicated history between we humans and deer. But first, with me to discuss the latest on bike safety and infrastructure updates across the area are Grace Gallucci, the Executive Director and CEO of NOAACA. Grace, thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you very much for your interest in the work that we are undertaking.
Absolutely. I've got my bike helmet right here on the table, so pretty appropriate to have this conversation. And Jenna Thomas joins us as well. She's the Advocacy and Policy Manager for Bike Cleveland. Jenna, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
We'd love for you to share your thoughts on this topic. Are you concerned or interested in bike infrastructure around Northeast Ohio? Give us a call, 866-578-0903, or email soi@ideastream.org, or tweet us, we're at Sound of Ideas. Grace, let's kick this off by talking about the Downtown Livability and Transportation Study, and the fact that this is really coming as we push to see downtown Cleveland as more of a residential neighborhood.
Yeah, actually, the Downtown Connectivity and Livability Study allows us to look at downtown Cleveland as a commercial center, which we always have, as a place of entertainment and cultural activities. But now it is much more of a residential center. And so now you have the confluence of three different types of trips and what that looks like in terms of coexistence.
Yeah, and it's safety really seems to be the keystone there. And it's not just cyclists, but this also deals with pedestrians, you know, intersections, crosswalks, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the study did find that traffic safety is a high priority. Mm-hmm. People are concerned very much about pedestrian and bicycle travel on foot and on bike. Puts folks in a way that perhaps makes them not feel comfortable on the streets of downtown Cleveland.
Yeah. And you worked with an engineer who notes in the study that Cleveland is lagging behind peer cities regarding a completed bike system. What would be, you know, potential projects or improvements that NOAACA and partners would target to kind of bring us up to speed with our peer cities?
I think one of the biggest things that we could do is look at our street network as a complete and green streets approach. And so we specifically looked at East 9th as a complete street opportunity. East 9th Street has high pedestrian activity, high vehicular volumes, and a high share, unfortunately, of fatal and serious injury crashes. And so that presents an opportunity for us to slow down the traffic. And what that looks like is putting in infrastructure, whether it be improved intersections, whether it be median refuges for the pedestrians. There's a lot of opportunity there. Protected bikeways is essentially the one way that we can simply put both pedestrians and bicyclists in a safer place.
And these are all kind of just thoughts and possibilities right now, but can you explain for maybe our listeners, there's a couple of diagrams on the report that I saw, what East 9th could look like potentially if we were to prioritize pedestrians and cyclists? Maybe this kind of center island with some more trees and some other protected items?
Yeah, we could see a median going down East 9th Street. That median should be green. Mm-hmm. Green often helps to slow things down. We would have protected bike lanes. So that means maybe putting East 9th Street on a diet, a road diet. And when you look at the improved intersections, I'd mentioned the median refuge, but then we can also have two-stage crossings, which allow it to be safer for folks crossing the streets at a slower pace.
Yeah. Jenna, as a rider and an advocate for Bike Cleveland, what's your reaction when you see a study like this? Are those the concerns that you hear from riders that you know?
Yes, absolutely. It makes sense that the survey conducted as part of this study found that traffic safety was a top priority among respondents. It also found that over a third of respondents felt unsafe riding a bike downtown. And mm-hmm. then our crash report found that around 50 bicyclist and pedestrian crashes occurred downtown last year, including a fatal crash. Elise Bodie was 30 years old, a week away from her wedding. She was finishing up her shift as a server at Cordelia. Her fiance came and met her to walk her home, and she was killed by a driver on East 9th in St. Clair. So, you know, I'm not 100% sure that a median center island and pedestrian scale lighting might save Elise's life, but these are definitely proven methods for preventing death and serious injury.
Yeah, and you're talking about East 9th, the same exact roadway we were talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, what's important to think about when you think about safety is, in fact, the facts, the numbers. 2% of all of the crashes in downtown Cleveland are pedestrian related. However, they represent 42% of all fatal crashes and 46% of all serious injury crashes. And when you think of East 9th, two out of the three fatal crashes were on East 9th.
Wow. Jenna, this 2023 crash report, 550 total individuals hit last year across the city of Cleveland, 9 deaths. Ward 3 includes downtown Cleveland and some of the west side. Can we dig in those numbers a little bit more? What does that look like if we're looking at downtown Cleveland in terms of who was hit, fatalities, where the pressure points kind of are?
Right. So, yes, Ward 3 had the highest number of people hit, 84, including 7 kids throughout Ward 3. And there were around 50 of those occurred downtown. Like I mentioned, Elise was one of the fatalities last year. And then there was another closer to West 9th as well.
Let's talk a little bit about putting this crash report together. I know there's some language there about how Cleveland lags behind other Ohio cities in terms of reporting and compiling information about crashes. What does this process look like to put together this 2023 crash report?
Yeah, so unlike previous analyses of crash data, our report looked at 911 calls. The way we've created policies and designed roads in the past have been based off of incomplete data, only looking at these official state reports called OH1s. And unfortunately, not every crash gets an official report. And sometimes for valid reason, like maybe the officers show up and everyone is gone, or it was actually a domestic violence situation and a car was being used as a weapon. I saw a few cases of that. But those instances don't alone account for the 300 crash disparity between our report and what the state would say the number of crashes were last year. We've also found that Cleveland in particular was slow to submit those reports to the state, nearly 2 months often, and compared to peer cities like Cincinnati, Columbus, Toledo, which are submitting reports 1 to 6 days after the crash.
You and I talked a little bit on a pre-interview before this this conversation, and I think you were saying that this could be far below the actual number of incidents we see in and around Cleveland in terms of reporting.
Yes, absolutely. Not everyone who gets hit by a car calls the police for a number of reasons. And I think that, you know, serious injury crashes are probably more are better accounted for, and we have pretty accurate numbers there. But we don't have accurate numbers on how many people are being hit, how many children are being hit. It was often bystanders calling in for kids getting hit.
Wow.
And so you think about the number of times that no one is around to call.
Yeah.
So we are encouraging, you know, better data collection on the city side.
If you're just joining us here on The Sound of Ideas, I'm talking with Grace Gallucci from NOACA and Jenna Thomas from Bike Cleveland. We're talking about bike safety and infrastructure. If you'd like to join the conversation, 866-578-0903, or the email is soi@ideastream.org. We did get an email from Daryl. He asks, is RTA incorporating bicycle planning into their planning for new bus rapid transit routes? Grace, I'll toss that to you. I know that transit safety and accessibility is kind of part of this NOACA study as well.
So NOACA partnered with the City of Cleveland, RTA, and Downtown Cleveland Alliance to work the study. So obviously the answer is yes. RTA is very concerned about it being inclusive in terms of their riders. They have had bike racks on the buses and in the trains for probably 25 years. So clearly they have thought about bicyclists.
Yeah. When you hear about this crash report from Bike Cleveland, how do you see this kind of fitting into all of NOACA's priorities? And you just talked about working with the City of Cleveland, working with RTA. You know, you guys have a lot, your hands in a lot of pots and a lot of priorities. And like, how does bike safety and pedestrian safety kind of fit in that big picture?
Over the last decade or so, we have been placing much more emphasis on bicycle, pedestrian, and public transit travel. We know that our region is very well outfitted for vehicular travel, motorized travel, not as much for foot, bike, and public transit. So our long-range plan, ENEO 2050, has been focusing on trying to implement projects that would bring to the forefront how you can have a more equitable travel network. So that's kind of what we've been doing. And so how those statistics, the study done by Cleveland and the work that they're doing, it underscores what we're trying to do. And I think vice versa. I think the work that we're doing helps to shed light on the seriousness of the issue as expressed by those reports.
Yeah. And Jen, I saw you kind of nodding your head there and how these reports work together. You know, a lot of long-term projects in store for the City of Cleveland. You talked about this NEO 2050 item. What about short-term remedies? Anything on your kind of like wish list, Jenna, or in an ideal world in the next couple of years, these things happen to make bicyclists and pedestrians safer in and around downtown Cleveland?
Sure. So things we know are happening include the Superior Midway, which is around a 2.5-mile segment of separated bike facilities from Public Square to East 55th along Superior. But, you know, that will start construction next year and won't be finished until 2027.
And we'll talk about a little bit more about that later.
Great. Yeah. And, yeah, we're definitely interested in seeing more short-term interventions. There are not every project has to cost this many millions of dollars and has to be, you know, these, like, very high-quality materials, you know, plastic posts and concrete parking stops can be great separators for travel lanes and bike lanes. They're cheaper, they're easier to install. And so, you know, getting our downtown bike network down on the ground, you know, between this year and next year is definitely a priority for us.
Yeah. Grace, you want to jump off of that?
I think we have identified short-term, medium-term, and long-term implementations that can make the not only downtown Cleveland, but around the region safer for bicyclists and pedestrians. And, you know, when you think about public transit, you start off either as a pedestrian or a bicyclist or both.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us on The Sound of Ideas, we're talking bike safety and infrastructure in and around downtown Cleveland. We'd love to have your thoughts. 866-578-0903. Again, that number, 866-578-0903. Or you can always send us an email, soi@ideastream.org. Jenna, something that jumped out of this report was 13 wheelchair users were hit last year. I wonder about recommendations again from both of you. Is there something we can do to better protect people that are using wheelchairs in and around downtown Cleveland? Does that just go right to, you know, broader intersections, better light switching systems in terms of giving more time to cross intersections?
Yes, definitely intersection treatments that will slow cars down, like curb extensions. But I also, I often see wheelchair users using bike lanes, and so I see protected bike lanes as infrastructure for wheelchair users as well.
Yeah.
Especially when it's snowing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And the sidewalks aren't clear, but the street is. Having a bike lane and a separated, you know, place for people in wheelchairs is great.
Yeah. Grace, you want to jump off that point too?
Yeah, I think in addition to the capital projects, when you think about programs and policies, improvement in the regulation of curb lane and sidewalks, improving the accessibility and ensuring that the maintenance of the streets and sidewalks are up to par.
And is that you work? Is that NOAACA working with the city of Cleveland and kind of keeping up the conditions of sidewalks and roadways?
NOAACA really does measure the condition of the roadways, not as much sidewalks. Maybe that's something that we ought to really think about. But the city does a terrific job of, they've got a terrific department of capital projects and streets and maintenance that do those functions. And I think, you know, we're here to help them. We're here to put out studies that help to lead the way on where perhaps to address some of these issues, but really the city is doing that.
Yeah. We did get a tweet from Cliff. Some parts have bike lanes, but I never see a rider using them. And in one area in Cleveland, the curb and curbside parking was removed to create a bike lane. How is that fair to small businesses in the area? I think he means small businesses. I know this is something that we can talk about with the potential Lorraine Midway, but is there a conversation that you have, especially with business owners, where they're worried about parking for their businesses? You want to foster pedestrian access to these businesses, but then there could be a pushback. Where are people going to park? Where are they? You know, how are they going to safely access these businesses?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern for the business owners, and definitely a conversation we have with them during the public engagement portion of our studies. But I think over and over again, reality has shown that the concern is not as founded as perhaps they might initially believe. That people adapt, people adjust, and if you're trying to increase pedestrian and bicyclist travel, you often have more customers to those businesses.
Jenny, you want to jump off that point?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the success of businesses is really important to us on these corridors. I also want to say, I often hear, you know, I don't see people using these bike lanes. And as a rider, someone who rides around quite a bit, I definitely see people using the bike lanes. I often see people using sidewalks, and that's because we don't have high quality bike lanes that people feel safe riding in. I frankly think like a business model reliant entirely on a parking spot directly in front of the business is not a very, very resilient one. People will definitely adjust. A few weeks ago on February 29th at 7 a.m., a driver drove completely into a building at West 44th and Lorraine, and the storefront was completely destroyed. And projects like the Lorraine Midway will prevent these kinds of terrible accidents, crashes from happening, and it'll make places much more pleasant to walk, roll, drive, everything.
Well, let's talk about this. We've kind of alluded to it a couple times. The Superior and Lorraine Midways, you know, Jenna, the Superior Midway will run from Public Square to about East 55th Street and has already secured funding. Where does this project stand right now? And kind of paint a picture for our listeners if they're not aware of what this will look like and what the timeline for this is.
Sure. So the Superior Midway is currently in its design phase. We're still getting public feedback, and what this will be is a center of the road. Imagine like a multi-use path for cyclists with greenery on either side. It'll be completely separated, raised. It'll feel very safe from cars. And Superior, I mean, as it is, it's incredibly wide, does not have many cars. And it will look entirely different, feel much better to walk and drive and bike on.
The Superior Midway actually came out of a NOAACA TLCI, so again, Transportation for Livable Communities Initiative, and then that allowed us to secure funding. So the funding that is paying for the Midway is coming from NOAACA CMAQ, or Congestion Mitigation Air Quality Dollars. So again, this is a way to suggest that we may start, set the foundation for studies, and then partnering with the city, and they move it forward to implementation.
Right. I read that NOAACA Amtrak is contributing about almost $20 million in federal dollars to the Superior Midway project. Why did NOAACA see that as a really worthwhile investment in terms of a big project here in Northeast Ohio?
So one of the things that started us to look at the kind of project that the Midway represents is a roadway like Superior has more capacity than it really needs. And so we don't have the vehicular travel on that road that perhaps we once did.
Yeah.
And so that gives us an opportunity to use it in a different way. And using it in a different way means making it more aligned with pedestrian, bicyclists, and public transit.
The Lorain Midway in Ohio City could potentially run from West 65th to West 25th. This project is still in its infancy, and there's been some controversy over parking along the stretch. Jenna, kind of what do we know about that project so far? What's been the back and forth between advocates for this Midway and maybe some of the residents or businesses in the area?
Sure, yes. Like you said, it's still in its very early stages, really getting kind of preliminary designs together. And we're looking forward to having more conversations with businesses and finding solutions to ensuring that all modes of transportation have access to these businesses. There is plenty of parking in and around Ohio City. These businesses are in one of the most walkable neighborhoods in the city of Cleveland. And in our mind, frankly, like once the Lorain Midway is done, I can't imagine a better street to own a business on.
Yeah.
It's going to be way more pleasant to be on and to be able to jump between businesses and explore and like feel more connected to the city.
Mm-hmm. You know, NOAACA's vision statement for all of our work throughout the five-county region speaks to multimodal transportation systems for the purpose of enhancing quality of life and economic vitality. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about when you think of businesses, we want businesses to thrive. We want to provide them the infrastructure that makes their world a better place as well.
Yeah. What would NOAACA need to hear about this Lorain Midway project to either secure funding for it or to really put their full backing behind this? Are you guys looking for more studies, more feedback from residents or businesses? What kind of would be that next step for this project?
So NOAACA has already put a significant amount of funding towards the Lorain I guess we're not calling it a midway, the
streetscape.
Or,
yeah.
And we've put the maximum that we can put there based on our funding source, congestion mitigation, air quality dollars. So we do back the project.
Yeah.
We are aligned with the city of Cleveland. But again, as I said before, when it comes to the implementation, we really lean on the city as well as we look to them for that leadership.
Mm-hmm. And what does the relationship look like? We keep talking about funding for these projects, and that's, I think, a really big thing for our listeners to understand. What does that relationship look like between NOAACA and state departments and federal departments when you're talking about these reports from Bike Cleveland? How do you guys kind of coalesce all of that information and feedback from residents and then go to whatever body you need to go to say, look, this is why we need to support this infrastructure. This is why we need to build XYZ lane here or there.
As I said earlier, you know, data is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the history and looking at the future and sort of bridging that gap is what we need to do. When we talk about funding, it is a way to help us secure funding. It's a way to help us advocate for that funding. And it's a way to really convince our legislators that there is an issue and that they are in the position to solve that issue, that the opportunity is there. At the federal level, we have unprecedented funding in the IIJA, which is the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. That's going to give us funding that we have not seen in a generation. This is the time. Now is the time to act on these kinds of studies.
Yeah. One more survey I wanted to touch on today before we close. A couple minutes left if you want to join the conversation. 866-578-0903 or SOI at ideastream.org. Bike Cleveland and Baldwin Wallace teamed up and talked to more than 600 people for this survey. Big takeaway was 75% of residents support more public investment to improve safe access to bicycling, walking, and use of public transportation. And 66% who ride a bike said they are concerned about getting hit by a car while biking. Jenna, how do these responses kind of bolster the same thing that we're talking about, where you want people to ride, but they don't feel safe riding, and
right,
kind of this snake eating its own tail?
Right. I mean, that is why we talk about an all ages and abilities bike network. I bike on Lorraine every day to get to work, but I would not expect my little sister or my grandma to feel comfortable doing so. But the Midway projects and other future, you know, separated bike facilities and neighborhood greenways are meant to be for families and seniors and anyone who wants to feel safer on two wheels.
Yeah.
I mean, it's daunting for me. I noticed the two of you came in on bicycle today. Yeah. I did not. I drove in and then I walked from my office to here. I would perhaps consider riding a bike if it felt safer.
Yeah. And I think we have that the tweet from Cliff that came in was that there is this perception that you have bike lanes out there, but people aren't using them. So if we don't, you know, if you build it, they will come, but they still don't see people using them. But there is that overwhelming fear of being hit or being safe. So, you know, I know what the step that maybe NOAACA would take or what they need to hear from residents to say, okay, we're gonna build this and then see what happens.
Well, I think we've heard what people have had to say, and safety is a number one concern, and we want to address that. So we want continued investment in public infrastructure that supports a truly multimodal transportation system, which then includes pedestrians, bicyclists, and public transit, in addition to the normal streets for motorized vehicles.
Jenny, you want to jump off that point?
Yeah, and I think this gets to the point that bike lanes, especially protected bike lanes, are safety enhancements for everyone on the road. They slow cars down by narrowing the lanes, and they shorten crossing distances for pedestrians, not to mention the obvious safety improvements for bicyclists. I think it's a win-win-win.
And we don't really have time to get into this, but I know that part of the other aspect of the NOAACA study is lakefront connectivity, you know, this whole shore-to-core-to-shore thing that the Mayor Bibbs administration wants to do. Part of these bike infrastructure upgrades could contribute to more lakefront access. But we're going to have to leave it there. I do want to thank Grace Gallucci, President and CEO of the Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency. Grace, thanks for being in the studio with us today.
Sure, just want to leave you with one thought. Yeah. City streets are for all people.
There we go. And Jenna Thomas is the Advocacy and Policy Manager for Bike Cleveland. Jenna, thanks for being on today.
Thank you.
Time now for a quick break, but on the other side, the long, complicated relationship we have with deer. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Drew Mazias, in for Jenny Hamill today. We'll be back in a minute. You're back with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Drew Mazias, in the host chair today. Thanks so much for spending the hour with us. If you're a Northeast Ohio resident, chances are you see deer everywhere. They might not be the most common wildlife we come across, but they often make their way into residential gardens, feed in small groups in a public park, and unfortunately end up on the sides of roads and highways as a result of vehicular collisions. Because of human population growth and our expanding footprint, we're now more than ever living in close proximity to deer. In her new book, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors, Erica Hauser examines this long relationship, one that involves everything from Native Americans and their use of every piece of a deer to her own experiences trying to protect her garden from these invaders, to some of the more complicated aspects of our interactions, like hunting, culling, and dealing with roadkill. I caught up with Hauser recently to discuss The Age of Deer. Erica Hauser, welcome to The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much for having me, Drew. Happy to be here.
I'm always curious where the idea for a book comes from. You're a writer with a couple of books of poetry under your belt, which I read, and you have a history of working in journalism. But how did you come to put together this book all about deer?
Well, you know, I have a longstanding interest as a writer in issues of what we call nature and the environment, but my primary interest is in questioning what those terms even mean. So I'm interested in how humans fit into the landscape. I'm interested in why we have this habit of drawing a kind of bright line between ourselves and whatever we think of as nature. And I'm interested in the kind of gray areas where the human realm and the natural realm actually overlap and influence each other, and where we can see that, in fact, we are not separate from nature. And at some point, it occurred to me that deer would be a really good way to investigate that gray area and ask those kinds of questions. One of the things that's really unique about them is that, especially in the eastern U.S., they're more or less the last large wild animal that people encounter in their daily lives. We don't tend to live around a lot of large wildlife anymore, and we know that a lot of species have been lost from our, you know, kind of daily world that we live in. But deer are still here, and they're our neighbors. They're good at living among us. So that creates a lot of really interesting issues, you know, some conflicts and some connections, and just a lot of ways to investigate, as I said, that gray area where the human and the natural worlds overlap.
The evolution of your relationship with deer before and after writing this book, I'm sure, is probably a pretty complex thing to ask you about. But can you talk about what your common interactions were before you were writing this book? I'm sure they echo a lot of what people here in Northeast Ohio are experiencing, even though you're in Virginia. You know, them coming into your garden or driving on a rural road and seeing deer off to the side. Can you talk about what your experience with them was like before writing this book, and how those interactions have changed since, if at all?
Sure. Well, I grew up a little bit closer to Cleveland than where I am now. I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I was kind of adjacent to the deer hunting culture there, which is strong. It's a big part of life there. I did have relatives who were deer hunters and family friends, so I certainly grew up with deer hunting as a kind of element, you know, in the world around me as a kid. And then as an adult here in Virginia, like you said, I have had deer come into my garden. I've, you know, just spotted them a lot when I'm walking in the woods or driving in the car. And I realized at some point that they are just so ubiquitous, but in a very quiet way. You know, you notice them and they look back at you, and there's kind of a moment of connection, but they're not, I say in the book, I think they're not exclamation point animals. We kind of remark upon them, but at the same time, there's something very just quiet and common about them. And that interested me. But I, you know, my interactions with deer are, as you suggested, they're very ordinary. You know, I share them with many, many other people. And I think the process of writing the book really deepened my appreciation for them in a lot of different ways, you know, looking into how much spiritual significance they've had over the millennia for humans in different cultures and places, how important they've been in American history, which I really wasn't aware of before I started to research this, and some of the perils that they face. That makes me appreciate the fact that they are here now. And I would say also my interactions with hunters and my experience of observing hunting also taught me something about what it means to go out looking for an animal as opposed to just passively happening to see them, and sort of going out with that hunter's mindset of trying to find them. That really changes the whole experience of, you know, a spotting, because if you're going out looking for deer and you do spot one, it's extremely exciting. You know, it's really different than just you're walking your dog and you happen to run across one.
Yeah. I'm really glad you mentioned the spiritual aspect of this, because I was really fascinated by some of the early chapters in your book. Early, you reference just how many early and primitive cultures across the globe use deer iconography. Easy to say this is because deer are just found in so many places across the globe, but why else do you think they've resonated so much with humans, and we've chosen to incorporate them into so many of our religious rituals or artwork?
Yeah, I think the simple answer to that is because they've been so important to us as providers of food, obviously, but also we use their hides and we've used their bones to make tools. And, you know, there are many cultures, including a lot of indigenous cultures here in North America, that have been able to find uses for almost every part of a deer, even the scat and the urine. So when you have that kind of material relationship with an animal, I think that from that comes this very deep spiritual connection too. There's something very uncomfortable about having to kill in order to live, right? In order to get food, we've had to take the lives of these large, beautiful beings who are, you know, I think it's significant that they're so similar in size to us. Mm. I think that means we can really see ourselves in them. And so there's something, it's kind of a psychological hotspot for humans to have to kill an animal that's so big and beautiful, but at the same time, it's been a necessity. So all these myths and rituals have come up around that to try to kind of contain or soothe that discomfort and that paradox of loving and admiring and also killing and consuming. There are all these really interesting images and myths in which humans and deer shapeshift into each other. And I think that really comes from that kind of fundamental act of eating the meat of another being and you know, taking that into your own body and kind of the mystery of whether, you know, when you do that, are you becoming that animal or is that animal becoming you? It's kind of both. And so all these myths about shape-shifting deer who turn into humans and vice versa, I think really maybe come from that.
Mm-hmm. You've been referencing the gazing at a deer or locking eyes with a deer and being the same size. And I think that is really fascinating. Maybe something I didn't really consider reading this book about how a lot of these creatures are, you know, maybe 5-6 feet tall when they're standing up and how that's a lot different than looking at a rabbit or a squirrel or some kind of other game that someone might be hunting.
Yeah, it really is. And they do just have this, you know, it's interesting throughout art history, they've often been pictured as silhouettes or outlines, usually in profile, you know, or they're, you know, maybe kind of above you on a cliff. It's a majestic stag and you're looking up at him, but he's not looking at you. So all these deer in art history that don't look back, I think is really, really kind of strange because their nature as kind of prey animals is that they're very alert and aware, and they certainly do look back at us because that's one of their primary, you know, sort of defenses is to know where we are and keep an eye on us and, mm-hmm. and other predators. So it's just an interesting thing to contrast that with the way we've pictured them as sort of there to be looked at, but not looking back.
Mm. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Erica Hauser. She's the author of The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. I was fascinated by this myth of Eden that you write about and how you kind of tied that to fluctuations in deer population in pre-colonial times up to the 20th century. Can you give a little summary of what you discovered through your research about how deer populations have changed? Because it doesn't seem to be as simple as, you know, white colonialists came in, deer populations plummeted, kind of end of story. It seems to be a little more complicated than that.
Yeah, there is a lot of complexity to it. You know, starting with the fact that Native Americans and deer experienced a changing and fluctuating relationship over time as well. And we don't know as much about that. But certainly, you know, during the time that indigenous cultures have been here on this continent, the deer populations have gone up and down and experienced changes as a result of interactions with humans and as a result of other factors too. And once Europeans came, there was a kind of a seesaw, I would describe it, a seesaw effect in the deer population. There was an initial decline that came about as a result of the trade in hides, which was a transatlantic trade, you know, the early colonials, especially in the South, the southeastern United States, were kind of facilitating this trade in which Native hunters would hunt deer, Native women would process the skins, and those would be sold to buyers in Europe. And this became a really big business and caused a drop in the deer population. That ended around the American Revolution. And then the whole period that followed the Revolution, in which, you know, Americans were pushing west and there was all this settlement happening, that saw more hunting and kind of overuse of deer. But there was also, there were some factors during that time that could temporarily encourage deer to have a resurgence. Like, for example, when settlers were establishing farms, kind of using them up, using up the soil, depleting the soil, and then abandoning those farms to go further west and find fresh ground, those abandoned farms where vegetation would be growing back, that was a an excellent place for deer to thrive. So there were these factors that helped deer bounce back, but in the main, they did suffer a very severe decline that around the turn of the 20th century was so severe that there were entire states that were completely empty of deer. And I think Ohio was one of those. So what turned that around was the birth of a new conservation movement. Teddy Roosevelt is an important figure in that early conservation movement. And it's interesting to realize that most of the folks who were really involved in that were hunters. So one of their primary motivations was to save deer as a game animal because they didn't want to lose the opportunity to hunt large game. So they did a few things. They put states in charge of regulating wildlife and hunting. They outlawed commercial hunting because there had been a very brisk trade in venison. You know, people made their living by hunting deer and then selling the meat to restaurants or to markets, butchers. So that went away. And the really surprising thing is that some of these conservationists began programs to restock deer. So to actually move deer around from one place to another or one state to another to reseed those populations. So that was in the early 20th century. The populations, as we know, really took off. In the eastern U.S., we had also wiped out most of the large predators. So deer now had the opportunity to come back in an environment where human hunters and cars were really the only, you know, the only predators they had.
Yeah.
So that's how we ended up with, you know, what many people for the last few decades have considered to be an overpopulation, an overabundance.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay on the population track and talk about deer culling. You follow around a man named Jim who says he believes in culling because it, quote, means less suffering all around for the deer. How did you view your time looking into the act of culling a deer population? How did your experience with Jim change your perspective or inform your perspective on the act of culling?
Sure. Well, so culling is the term for when a community, or sometimes it's an entity like a national park, when they decide that they do have too many deer and they need to take action to reduce the population, lethal action. So this could be done by a local police department. It's sometimes done by special organizations who do that kind of work in different places around the country. And that's the case in Princeton, New Jersey, which is where Jim works. He works for the city of Princeton as an animal control officer. And what I did was to shadow him for an evening when he was driving around town to different sites where deer had just within the last few hours been killed, and he was collecting the carcasses and bringing them to a butcher who would cut them up and prepare them to be donated to a food bank. So, you know, it's a pretty intense scene, and there's definitely sorrow in that experience and some confusion. I would say that what I came away with was, like many other issues in the book, culling is something that I really couldn't find any easy answers about. There are very compelling arguments for and against it. I could see that the people involved had different degrees of sadness about it. And Jim acknowledged as much that although he does really believe that program is doing the right thing, he also does feel sadness about participating in it. And so for me, I just really came away with a sense of the complexity of it all. I feel grateful that I don't have to be the one to make the policy decisions, but my job is just to show up and observe and kind of report to readers. But I think these are really, really difficult issues, and they stem from the really deep, far-reaching changes that we've made to the earth.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Erica Hauser. She's the author of The Age of Deer. You write about the demographics of people who hunt and who make up the spaces that kind of interact with deer the most, and they're mostly white men. But you talk a little bit about the contrast of like working with hides and how many white faces are engaged in that practice, which is a very specific practice to Native American people that were doing that for centuries. What are some of your reflections on who interact with deer the most and through various activities like hunting and then kind of this frontiersman, these frontiersman activities, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, well, this question takes us back to Teddy Roosevelt and that whole context of hunting as conservation and a kind of marriage between hunting and conservation. Roosevelt and his contemporaries involved in that movement, they were, by our standards today, they were pretty unenlightened about things like race and ethnicity. And some of them were, you know, openly advocating for eugenics at that time. So the way they set up that conservation slash hunting movement was fairly explicitly as a realm for white men to participate in. And they did connect very much to those frontiersmen kind of forebears like Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett. In fact, the Boone and Crockett Club, which mm-hmm. Roosevelt helped to found and named after Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett, is, and you know, still today, one of the kind of premier hunting conservation organizations in the U.S. And so he was really, another story about Roosevelt is that he posed wearing a kind of traditional fringed buckskin outfit. You know, it's like, it looks like something that Daniel Boone would have worn. He had his photo taken wearing this. And the clothing was actually made for him in New York City by Brooks Brothers. So he was not a frontiersman. Yeah. He was an elite New Yorker who was very self-consciously adopting that frontier look and persona as part of his work in this kind of conservation realm, which is fascinating, and the political realm, of course. So the echoes of all that are still very much with us in the fact that, you know, white men are the majority of people who hunt deer in this country. And, you know, hunters of color, women hunters, do find it sometimes very challenging to break into that space.
Mm-hmm. I want to end to this conversation by asking about something that you wrote about in the end of the book. And I really loved this one excerpt. Near the end, you write about the attitudes of people who hunt versus those who maybe hike or backpack. And you do a little bit of comparing of the consumptive habits of those two groups. You write, quote, "Getting to the top of a hill feels good, but is it really as meaningful as standing over the deer you killed and will eat?" That seems like such an interesting paradox to me, and how people like myself who hike, they feel like they might be communing with nature, but maybe it's in a more superficial or shallow way than someone who's out there hunting a deer in the woods.
Yeah, you know, I did come to reflect on that. I have never identified as a hunter in my life. And on the other hand, I have identified as a hiker and someone who likes to be outside in this kind of leave no trace way. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is there's a tradition of hunters saying, you know, we have the deepest connection to wildlife that there is. And I think there's something to that. And some of the most incredibly thoughtful and connected people that I know in terms of how they spend time outside are hunters. So I think this gets at some of our cultural divides, some of our political divides, some of the assumptions that we make about each other. And I feel glad that because my brother and some of my other relatives are hunters, that I had this opportunity to be with them in the field and to just kind of witness the reality of what it means to go out into the woods, sometimes right on the edge of town. It doesn't have to be wilderness, but to go out and harvest wild, it's a pretty profound thing.
The book is The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. Erica Hauser, thank you so much for talking to us today on The Sound of Ideas.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Again, that was my conversation with Erica Hauser. The book, The Age of Deer, is out now. To get the last word on today's topics, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me there. I'm at DJ Mazzy Maz. Tom had some thoughts on that conversation about deer, he writes in. I live in a city that has a culling program, but also has a growing number of incidents of coyote interactions. When we cull the main food source for the coyote, they will move into the city to eat small dogs and cats. Why not let their populations balance each other naturally? Thanks for the feedback, Tom. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, IdeaStream's Akron-Canton reporter Abigail Botar will discuss Akron's latest co-responder pilot program aimed at decreasing use-of-force incidents for mental health emergency calls. And Stephen Langell, our other reporter, chats with Cleveland Heights native Peter Bendix, new president of baseball operations for the Miami Marlins. Very appropriate as the MLB season starts this week. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. I'm Drew Mazzius. Anna Huntsman is in the host chair for the next 2 days. Jenny's back with you next Monday. I'll talk to you soon.